Hi, I'm Tess Viglin, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 4th, 2011. The unemployment rate finally dropped below 9% last month, but for the long-term unemployed, it's about a lot more than losing a paycheck.
I lost a part of who I was. No longer was I the successful career woman I had been so proud to be. It was a massive blow to my ego.
We'll explore the unemployment identity crisis. And so much for the old ideal of job, marriage, and maybe even kids in the years after you graduate from college.
It takes much longer for young people to achieve those things today, if ever, and the routes there are a lot more complicated.
A look at the new, slower path to adulthood. And fear not, cubicle dwellers of the world, change is a-coming.
You are the CFO?
Yes, I am.
And you don't have a door?
No, I don't.
Do people walk by and bug you like we just did a lot?
Of course.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Viglund, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. 2 years ago this weekend, investors were in full-on panic mode. On Friday, March 6th, 2009, the Dow closed just above 6,600. 3 days later, it hit what turned out to be the bottom of a long slide in the wake of the financial crisis. At the time, people yanked billions of dollars out of stocks. In other words, they sold low. Sound familiar?
Well, when the market turned, I lost about 50% of my current investments.
I was a little scared, but I don't know. I feel more confident now, but I feel like I don't have any other options. So.
Yeah, I pulled some out. Some I should have pulled out quicker.
I converted a lot of those stocks to cash, just afraid of, certain that I had to protect what I had.
I moved 40 to 45% to bonds. Kind of feel like you have to do something, not just leave it the same.
I've increased the percentage of contribution in my 401k. So I'm tiptoeing back into the market, you could say.
2 years later, the Dow has almost doubled, hovering around 12,000. And investors have thrown more than $30 billion at mutual funds and ETFs just since the start of the year. In other words, they're buying high. Well, Jason Zweig of the Wall Street Journal has a name for all those folks piling into stocks right now, and he joins us to talk about them. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tess.
Now, this is something I talked about last week on the show. A lot of investors seem to be getting back into the market whole hog. And a lot of these folks are the same ones who dumped out when the Dow hit 6,500. You refer to these investors as sheepish bulls. Tell us what you mean by that.
They're embarrassed. A lot of not everyone. But a lot of these investors are well aware of how their behavior seems to other people because I think it's how it seems to themselves. They say, well, I sold low, so now I'm buying high. That doesn't sound right, but I guess I need to do it anyway. You know, part of the problem is that the human brain will always seek to buy high and sell low because it feels better. You want to buy something that's going up, because it seems obvious that it'll keep going up. And you certainly want to sell something that's going down because it seems to you it has nowhere to go but further down. The problem is that buy low and sell high is a better idea financially. It just doesn't strike the human brain as being intuitive.
What really struck me in your article is you talked to financial planners all over the country, and they told you that people are actually getting more into stocks now than they did before the crash.
Yeah, in some cases, that's the behavior that people described to me. And I puzzled over it a lot too, Tess. And there's two forces at work here. You know, the memories haven't yet completely faded of how horrible 2008 and 2009 were for people. We all know that. Most of us lived through it. But the second thing that's happening is that people have regrets. One way to think about this is that the pain of your loss is a snapshot, but your regret is a movie because every day, certainly at least until last week, it seemed, every day the market has been going up ever since. And to sit there and watch it go up day after day has triggered a lot of people who say to themselves, you know, I could have made that money if I hadn't gotten out.
And so they make up for it by getting even more into the stock market than they were?
I think that's some of the motivation. You know, if only I hadn't gotten out, I'd have more money than I do today. Since I did get out, I'd better get back in and then some.
Then what's kind of the course of action for people who find that, you know, they can relate to this, that they did get out when the market was tanking and they're buying now as the market is potentially topping? Do they just stop what they're doing?
Well, I think if you're one of those people, there are two things you can do. The first, you should freeze, take a good, long, hard look in the mirror and ask yourself whether the person you are today is really better able to withstand the pain of loss than the person you were 2 years ago was.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, 2 years ago, you couldn't stand it, and that's why you got out. So what makes you think today you will be able to withstand it if it happens again? That's the first thing. The second thing, if after you go through that exercise, you still feel determined to go forward, then please do it gradually, in small steps, over time. Cut the money into pieces and slice the time into increments. Don't just jump right back in with both feet.
Jason Zweig writes the Intelligent Investor column for the Wall Street Journal, and we've been talking to him over the years about this question of buy high, sell low, and trying to do the opposite despite your brain. Jason, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tess. Thanks for having me.
Retirement plans for government workers are getting a second look these days, not just in Wisconsin, but around the country. This week, Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa suggested raising the retirement age for newly hired city workers by 10 years to 65, and to cut pension benefits to 75% of salary instead of 100%. Many states are going a step further to look at getting rid of pensions altogether and replacing them with 401k-style plans. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Lots of us who work for businesses are familiar with 401k-style retirement accounts. Every paycheck, I set aside a percentage of what I make. Marketplace matches it, or at least will, next month when I qualify. I tend my account, make decisions about where to invest it, and ideally my balance sheet will grow so that years and years and years from now, when I'm ready to kick back and spend all my time baking bread and hanging out with my future grandkids, I can. At least that's how it's supposed to work.
Private sector employees have had a very hard time. They don't necessarily join the plan. They don't contribute as much as they should. They don't diversify their investments. They just make a host of mistakes.
Alicia Munell heads the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Before the crash, she says the typical person approaching retirement age had just $78,000 in their 401k. Again, before the market meltdown. That's not even close to enough for most people to stop working.
People who are going to be relying on them solely, only with Social Security in retirement, are really going to come up short.
As the recession proved, 401k-style plans aren't idiot-proof or even smart people-proof, and they have none of the guarantees traditional pensions offer.
I have to say the stock market performance over the last 3 years hasn't been terribly reassuring.
Olivia Mitchell is the head of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School of Business. She says 401k plans can work, especially for people who might want to change jobs. But it's hard to manage them well, and the risk is all with the account holder. Taxpayers are on the hook for traditional government pensions, which carry their own set of risks. Mitchell points to research showing that those pensions, also called defined benefit plans, are underfunded by more than $3 trillion, with a T, dollars in the U.S.
If you have a defined benefit plan that's underfunded, for example, the city of Philadelphia is about 45% funded. That means it's missing a lot of the money it needs to pay the benefits. That's not a secure promise either.
To be clear, even if states switch to 401k-style accounts for new employees, it's not a fix. They're still on the hook for the promises they've made to current and past employees. That underfunding, the $3-plus trillion pension hole that states and cities face, is enough to keep Dartmouth professor Andrew Samwick away.
If I were given the choice, I would want the money in hand as opposed to the promise made to me by the employer. because then I own the money and I control the money, and I'm not beholden to future generations of taxpayers.
Samwick says governments just have too many competing goals. They want to keep everyone happy, employees, taxpayers, so they make promises that they don't have the money to pay for now. Unfortunately, the pay for it a little later strategy seems to have caught on with a lot of 401k holders as well. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
Finally, some positive news on the employment front. Employers added 192,000 jobs to their payrolls in February, but that is just a teeny sliver of the unemployment problem. Behind each and every statistic is a person. And for the next few months, we're bringing you some of their stories in a new series called The Job Chronicles. You'll hear about losing work and looking for it. And this week, Samantha Barnes describes what it's like to readjust to a new identity along with a new job.
After being laid off, I would pine after the memory of my job like a lost lover. It was a cushy executive sales position at a behemoth of a multinational corporation. Our client base was major U.S. banks and broker-dealers. We had an image to upkeep in order to blend in with our clients. We had lax expense accounts. In late 2008, when the banks started having problems, so did our business. I was one of those women you see in the airport, wearing fancy suits and flying across the country for client meetings. Checking email on her BlackBerry, calling her support staff with follow-up items. After my layoff, I would see them in the airport and want to yell out, "I'm one of you! I was important! People used to ask for my opinion during meetings!" I was the breadwinner of my family, and I was proud of it. I liked being able to pay the bills and buy things my family wanted but maybe didn't need. I liked being the provider. It was part of my identity. So I lost more than just the sales meetings at the beach and status shoes. I lost a part of who I was. No longer was I the successful career woman I had been so proud to be. It was a massive blow to my ego. Once my job search began, my ego didn't fare much better. I realized that there were thousands of people like me who had also lost their jobs, all well-respected in their previous positions and qualified for the positions I wanted. I felt very ordinary. The job I settled for was also very ordinary, definitely without the status to which I had become accustomed. Worse, I barely made more than my husband. I couldn't pay the bills, let alone buy my family what they asked for. I had to relinquish being the provider and the status that went with it. I know that there are other people trying to redefine themselves now that they are no longer the family breadwinner. Perhaps that's the upside. I learned that I am one of many people whose egos have been bruised along with their careers. Losing my job has given me a humility I won't lose.
Samantha Barnes lives in Worthington, Ohio. Tell us your stories about jobs lost and found. Post on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is now that time in the show when we take on your money issues. Here to do that with me this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. It's great to be here.
Always happy to have you. But you know what? I'm going to get you started on a topic that might make some people's eyes glaze over, but it's important.
Why me? Why me, Tess?
Because you will make it interesting. And I have one word for you. Bonds.
I bet you're talking about municipal bonds.
Indeed, I am. Now, these are the bonds that local governments issue to pay for all kinds of things, including, you know, potholes and what have you. But boy, these things are getting a lot of press lately, and not for good reasons.
No, not for good reasons at all. And Tess, you're in California. You're living in one of the states that has roiled this municipal bond market.
You're welcome.
Yes, the budget deficit problems and the problems that are going on in Illinois. You know, every state and local government struggling with these budget deficits. And a couple of weeks ago, Meredith Whitney, she is a famous analyst because she's the one that sort of said Citigroup has no clothes. They're
right.
Going to have a lot of trouble. Well, she came out and said that there were going to be defaults of hundreds of billions of dollars in the market.
Kind of scary.
That was scary. So we get another report out recently by Nouriel Roubini's consulting firm. He's known as Dr. Doom and Gloom.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, it's going to be about $100 billion. And we're thinking, huh.
Yeah, chump change.
That's kind of good news. Not bad. Okay, we can live with this.
So what's the truth?
The truth is, if you follow the marketplace money mantra of diversification and investing in quality, you're going to be fine. The real problems in the market are in the lower quality issues. There are problems in issues that aren't backed by the full taxing power of the state or local government, but rely on revenues.
But how do you know if you have that?
In general, most people own them through mutual funds.
Right.
So the mutual fund will pretty much tell you we're investing in the higher quality issues, we're investing in the junk bond issues. I mean, they list them as high yield municipal bonds. I've always advocated for what are called GO municipal bonds, government obligation. You have the taxing power of the state that backs this particular municipal bond issue. I think that's a really good thing. So again, you want to be diversified, you want to stick with quality, and if that's your mantra, you should be okay.
All right, shall we head to the phones?
I think so.
Ellen is with us from Waynesboro, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you?
Ellen, we're hearing some sound behind you. Where are you?
I'm sorry, I'm at a hotel conference and I'm trying to find a quiet place. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. It just happened. I thought I was safe.
What kind of conference are you attending?
It's a conference on coastal issues, as in coastal states, oceans, you know, sea level rise, all that good stuff.
Do you work in the sustainability area?
I'm actually a writer, and so I write about it, but I'm not the expert.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Mm. So you're going to learn a lot then.
Yes, I am.
And then write about it.
And that's for free. I mean, you can read it for free.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Well, how can we help you out today?
Sure. I'm 64, first year of the baby boomer, and looking at 60s and 70s, and all of a sudden realize I haven't given much thought to long-term care insurance.
This is a subject that I think a lot of people are wondering about and that they haven't thought about. So what have you done anything on that front?
I haven't done very much.
Okay.
I've talked to a few people older than me and concluded that they didn't think it was a very good buy because there's so much uncertainty about what they would get. And I'm looking for information that really is not biased and would at least help me start giving this more thought.
Well, first of all, how prepared are you for retirement?
Not real. It's probably going to be 5 or 6 more years.
Chris, is this the time to start thinking about long-term care?
You know, long-term care insurance just isn't something that people sit down at the dinner table and, you know, just start talking about. But as we're getting older and all the concerns about Medicare, Medicaid, it's a worthwhile thing to research. I have mixed feelings, and I'm going to give you someone who I truly respect, who is very positive of long-term care insurance, and that's Jane Bryan Quinn. If you go to her blog, janebryanquinn.com, she has this wonderful story. Her late husband, last year of his life, cost $100,000. When she remarried, did she ask about his bank accounts? No. How about his investment portfolio? No. She asked, do you have long-term care insurance? He did. They got married. So that's one source. I'm more skeptical about it.
You are.
I have to tell you, Tess, I really am, Ellen. It's such a difficult product to analyze. Mm. And a couple of questions to ask yourself, Ellen, that I think everyone should is, what's your income going to be? Because if you're in a lower income bracket, long-term care insurance isn't worth it because you're going to go on Medicaid. The other thing is, can you really pay the premiums? I mean, not just at 64, 65, 66, but will you be able to continue to pay those premiums at 68, 69?
Chris, how big a chunk of the budget would that be?
It's a pretty big chunk of your budget. It's not cheap at all. Hmm. A couple of other options. I think the AARP is a very good resource in what they have about long-term care insurance. So between Jane Bryan Quinn, the marketplace money skepticism of Chris Farrell, and the AARP, I think you can gather a lot of pretty objective information.
And that's, I think, a good balance, which is really about all you can ask for right now.
So it gives you a few options, Ellen.
Well, I appreciate the information, and I will look at all those sources.
All right, terrific. Okay. Thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
And next we have Margaret, and she is in my hometown, Portland, Oregon. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, how are you?
What do you do there?
I'm a graduate student and I write on the side.
Oh, our second writer of the day.
Writers with financial problems, right?
Yeah. surprise, surprise.
I write fiction and I do a little freelance writing on the side to make some money.
So what can we help you out with today?
I was listening to your show about a month ago and I suddenly thought they might know the answer to this.
I hope so.
We were vacationing in Mexico, I don't know, a couple of years ago, and we got somehow bamboozled into purchasing a timeshare.
I don't think I've ever heard the word bamboozled used with timeshare before.
I'm sure. It was a momentary lapse of judgment that has turned into this albatross around our necks. So I'm trying to figure out, is there a way to literally get rid of this thing, sell it? Because what happens is they have these annual fees that just keep going up every year. At some point, it's cheaper to just like book a vacation in Hawaii than to go to one of these, you know, Mayan Palace resorts.
Can you talk about why you think you bought into it in the first place?
Yes. We had a very persuasive salesman. And then they were plying us with margaritas and, you know, promises of free rent-a-cars.
Free margaritas will do it every time.
So, next thing you know, we have a timeshare.
Have you used it at all?
We have used it. We've actually had a good time, but it's just not how we like to travel. But the other thing is you get these postcards weekly from companies that are claiming to get you out of the timeshare. They want money up front, and I think it's just a scam. So I don't know if there is a legitimate way to get rid of it or if we're saddled with going to the Mayan Palace for the next 50 years.
All right, Chris. Well, Margaret certainly is not the first to have this issue. This is not something that's easy to get out of.
It really is. I mean, here's the dirty secret of the industry. Margaret and almost everyone else that has bought into a timeshare is the victim of an aggressive sales pitch. And before we had the real estate crash, the rule of thumb was if you wanted to sell your timeshare, you would discount the price by 30 to 50%. Now, people have bought timeshares for $15,000, so trying to sell them for one. But the thing that I'm really happy that you said is that you've been getting these solicitations and you're wary of that. That's such a scam. I mean, I think this is one of those things where contact a developer, you know, see if there's a point at which the developer will buy it back, you know, and just release you from the contract. Right now, probably be a little bit difficult, but, you know, it's always worth a try working with the developer. There's a pretty good website, the Timeshare Users Group. They seem to be following the industry pretty closely. Perhaps they can help you find a buyer for it.
Yeah, I mean, I even thought of going to the resort and just like standing outside where they're selling it to other people and intervening and saying, I'll give it to you for $4,000 less than what they're going to. Here, you can have it.
You know, I think that's absolutely brilliant.
To the Mayan Palace.
Chris, what happens if she just decides to stop paying for this thing, kind of does a walk away like on a house?
Well, it's pretty much the same thing as a house. There's this rumor that's been going around. The timeshares in Mexico, they won't report it to the credit reporting bureaus. They do. And the real problem is they have very aggressive debt collection agencies. In fact, a lot of the people who are in the timeshare business, that's one of their side businesses.
So, Margaret, it really sounds like the best option for you is going to be to try to sell that thing.
Yeah. And like I said, it's fun.
Exactly. So I'd be opportunistic. The moment you can unload it, and then you say, okay, I was bamboozled once, not again.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Margaret.
Okay.
All right. And finally, we have Marlo, and she's in Chesterton, Indiana. Hi, Marlo.
Hi.
Where is that in Indiana?
It's Northwest Indiana. It's right by the Indiana Dunes.
Oh, okay. Do you know Dave Letterman's mom?
No, not yet. Maybe I'll meet her someday. That would might help me with my money problem.
What are the Indiana Dunes?
It's the largest national lakeshore in the country. It's just these huge dunes. There's a state park there.
So you can like take a three-wheeler out there and go up and down the sand?
No, I don't think so. I think you just go walk up there, and then when you're a kid, you run down and then tumble down.
So do you have kids that you take there?
Yeah, I have three kids. My oldest is Celeste. She's 11. And then Connor, he's 10. And then Gwendolyn is 4.
So what are you teaching them about money these days?
Well, that's actually my argument with my husband, is that their only example of how to spend money and live within your means is what we show them.
Right. And are you doing that?
No, not really.
Hence the call.
Yes.
All right, then. What are you doing wrong that we can help you right?
Well, I have a question. I'm not working right now. My husband works full time. He has a 403B.
That's the nonprofit equivalent of a 401K.
Yes. If our income barely covers monthly expenses, would it make sense for us to stop or reduce payments to his retirement fund temporarily?
How tight are things?
We're probably a little under what we need a month.
Does the employer provide a match into the 403B?
Yeah.
Okay. If you're going to do this, and I'm going to argue not to do it, the strong rule is that if you do reduce your contributions, you want to keep the full match. Because otherwise, what you're doing is basically taking a pay cut.
Chris, I mean, what we're talking about here is that they do not have enough money coming in the door to meet expenses going out.
Well, we're just always feeling petered or pay Paul, so yeah. to speak. Like, it's just a balancing act every month.
So how much could you do on the expense side? You know, how much room is there to clamp down on spending?
Definitely one of the problems with our household is that neither one of us is very good with money. We tend to not think about things in the long term, but if we have enough money for something and we want it, we buy it. And it's like this entitlement that we both struggle with. Like, if one person was a little bit cheaper, it might work out a little better for us financially because they could rein it in. But when you have two people making impulsive decisions, it makes it harder.
First of all, at the very least, you recognize that?
That's exactly what I mean. I think this is incredible. You've actually made the step, made the most important step of all. It sounds to me as if you're having this dialogue about trying to set a better example for your kids. You probably have a lot of very simple steps that you can take so you can keep the retirement savings plan and actually set a better example for your kids.
Marlo, have you and your husband actually sat down at the dinner table and gone over this question?
Well, not necessarily because it's scary, and you don't, you know, we've often talked about trying to, in a sense, make up a business plan for our house. Like, this is what we have to do. This is why we have to do it and stick to that. So we have something to keep in mind.
Well, I think that sounds smart. Like a great idea.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you hear the interview that we did with the authors of Spousonomics a couple of weeks ago?
Yes, I did.
So just sitting down and talking about it is incredibly difficult. But knowing that that's universal for most couples, you know, maybe that'll make it a little easier.
And one way to ease the stress of that is to set up, you know, a weekly money meeting, maybe half an hour. It prevents things from becoming more important than they are. And it allows you to deal with stuff in little chunks and have a conversation. And so it's not like you're going to try and solve this over a week, but you're just going to just institute this sort of process. And it keeps the stress level down, keeps the anger down, and stuff doesn't fester.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense, too. I mean, that's like real time dealing with what's going on with the money.
Yep.
As opposed to, you know, 4 days before you get paid freaking out.
Planning is always better than freaking out.
Yeah.
You going to set up a date night?
Yes, I'll talk to him when he gets home and we'll figure out a day to make the budget and then a day during the week. Where.
There you go.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marlo. If you've got a financial question, do tell us about it. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Yeah, it was fun, Tess.
And remember to check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. And we're going to take an educated guess that many of you have tax questions around this time of year. If so, now is the time to get them to us. We'll be doing a special tax show next month, so we want to hear what you want to hear. Go to marketplace.org/money and look for the button marked tax time or post your question on our Facebook page. From your questions to your comments, our senior producer and mail carrier, Deb Clark, is here. Hi, Deb.
Hello. Thankfully, I don't actually have to carry in this electronic age. Let's start with our good friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell.
I believe he just left the building.
Oh, I guess he did. Okay, but here's the secret I'm here to tell you. Not everybody always loves Chris.
Oh?
I know it's hard to believe. He is an extremely nice person. Good advice, too. But he really annoyed some folks last week with his commentary.
This is where he told people they're going to have to save a lot more for retirement.
Yeah, he did. He said that all these battles that are taking place in states like Wisconsin, et cetera, over pension benefits are basically just going to get worse. We should all pony up, plan for the worst, and make up the difference ourselves. Here's what Tracy Johnson from Bemidji, Minnesota, had to say to Chris.
My guess is that if we save 20% of our income, that leaves us with enough discretionary income to buy nothing. So all the people whose jobs depend on us buying things would shortly be out of a job, unable to save anything.
Luana Conley from Monterey, California, was similarly displeased.
I just heard you recommend that we save more, since we can no longer rely on pensions, public or private, Social Security or Medicare. Save what, pray tell, with reduced earnings to the point of subsistence, no raises in 5 years, and imminent threats of layoff for this educated public employee at a California university? What have I left to save?
All right. So nobody's going to be able to save for retirement. What's next?
So we really touched a nerve with your interview with Andrew Ferguson.
He is the author of Crazy You. That's the letter U. That's a book about trying to get his kid into college.
Yes. Getting into college, paying for college, that always gets a big reaction around here.
It does indeed. So what was the reaction?
So many people wrote in to say it paralleled their experience with college admissions. Others, Laura Mattson, said she appreciated the story, agreed that a college degree doesn't predict future happiness or success, but...
I have to take issue with the idea that college students don't learn that much. I had the privilege of attending Sarah Lawrence College, and it provided a fantastic education that I've used consistently through my master's degree, professional experience, and I'm continuing to rely on in my legal studies.
And a number of our listeners wrote in to defend a website that Ferguson had said you basically shouldn't waste your time on, like Teresa Bayer from New Rochelle, New York.
Perhaps if Ferguson had spent a little more time on College Confidential, he would have realized that most of the parents posting there have a lot of good advice about planning for college. Most parents advise for looking for financial safeties, avoiding massive debt, and loving the kid on the couch. There are frequent discussions about whether big-name colleges are worth the money and where you can find good deals.
Decide for yourself, I guess. Well, do let us know what has you hot around the collar. You can tweet me at Radio Tess. You can go to our Facebook page. And, of course, the now old-fashioned way, comment at marketplace.org/money. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Apple hogged the technology headlines this week with the splashy introduction of l'iPad 2. But for Google Android users, the news was not so pleasant. Turns out more than 50 apps had been infected with viruses designed to steal personal information, like passwords and account numbers. Before the malicious code was spotted, tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of users had downloaded it onto their phones. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
I'll admit it. I'm in a codependent relationship with my phone. I don't go anywhere without it. I rely on it for directions and to send me texts if my bank balance runs low. I use it for recipes and research. And when my kids ask a question I can't answer, I pick up...
Your phone.
Yeah. So is my phone smarter than I am?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But it's still not quite smart enough to protect all the valuable information passing through it. Hackers, turns out, are going after mobile phones because these days, that's where the money is. Nick DiPetrillo is at Crucial Security.
Mobile techs are definitely expanding, and mostly because consumers are buying more and more smartphones.
And using them like computers to pay bills and balance checkbooks. But Don Bailey, a security researcher at ISEC Partners, says smartphones aren't that secure.
I would really say that they're inherently vulnerable.
All your cool apps, even the one from your bank, are perched on top of a giant stack of technology, from your phone's operating system all the way down to the cell phone towers and the telephone company's switching system. And Bailey says every layer in that stack can be hacked.
All up and down the spectrum, you have vulnerabilities at every level.
Last year, Bailey and DiPetrillo figured out you could reverse engineer the National Caller ID database.
You can essentially build a list of names and cellular phone numbers, and that could include anybody in the United States, from celebrities to...
defense contractors, even aides to the president. Bailey realized they could use that list, sort of a homemade phone book, to track anyone who was carrying a mobile phone in their pocket as they moved around the country.
We really only spent a couple $100s. And when you think about that and think about the amount of power that you have with this kind of material, a couple $100 is an extremely dangerous thing.
For many consumers, $1.99 can be a really dangerous thing too. Bailey says lots of mobile security threats are likely to show up in app stores.
This is where the big players are going to be, right? Because this is where crimeware is going to start spawning and is spawning.
The folks that write crimeware are hoping you'll download an infective app and then it will capture your credit card numbers or passwords. Tyler Shields is a security researcher at Veracode. He hacked a BlackBerry that way, purely in the interest of science, of course. But Shields says there are some things consumers can do to protect themselves.
The first thing that you can do is only download your applications from a more trusted source, such as the iPhone App Store or the Android Marketplace.
Apple reviews all the apps in its store before they're sold. Android developers police their marketplace themselves, but there are millions of apps.
In security, there's no silver bullet.
Kevin Mafferty is co-founder of the mobile security firm Lookout. He says malicious apps are getting stealthier and smarter.
What we're seeing right now is this experimental stage of mobile malware where you have a very well-developed industry of malware writers on the PC, and they see mobile as a big opportunity.
Lookout and other firms offer free malware detection apps for most mobile platforms. But Mafferty says the best protection may be common sense. Pay attention to what you do when you're on a public Wi-Fi network. Keep an eye out for suspicious charges. And if your phone starts acting funny, sending texts or emails on its own, or even if its battery life drops dramatically, take it in and have an expert check it out. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes baby in the baby carriage. And maybe there's a job somewhere in there, too. Those are the traditional markers of adulthood for young people in this country. But more and more 20-somethings take a different route, a slower one, one marked by significantly less independence. And Richard Setterston has written a book about them. It's called Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Tess.
So what exactly does a slower path to adulthood look like? Describe that for us.
Sure. I mean, what we've been studying is really just how much these big traditional markers of adulthood have changed. Things like leaving home, finishing school, finding work, getting married and having kids. Those are kind of the big five sociological markers we've traditionally thought about as kind of comprising the path to adulthood. And mm-hmm. what we know about those is that, you know, it takes much longer for young people to achieve those things today, if ever, and the routes there are a lot more complicated.
How much of that has to do with the economy?
Well, a lot of it, but it's not necessarily about the recession per se. The recession has mainly heightened a set of patterns that have been in the works for decades, actually. Some big themes around the economy really are that it takes much longer today to get jobs or find jobs that allow you to live independently, let alone raise a family. And it also takes a whole lot more in terms of resources to get launched. The cost of school, the cost of living, the cost of housing, for example.
When we talk about delaying kind of the onset of living like an adult, I think probably the image that comes first and foremost to a lot of people's minds is, you know, moving back in with mom and dad. And, you know, the common term that's used is mooching. But is this perhaps kind of the new post college graduate lifestyle?
You know, we've always thought about living at home as a problem because leaving home has always been the traditional marker of independence. And independence has always been the traditional marker of adulthood. So when kids start staying at home longer or coming home later, it's not a surprise that public concern grows up about it. But if you take a kind of historical view and look at the time before World War II, most people are pretty surprised to learn that rates of living with parents were equally high, if not higher, for the decades before the war. It was the conditions after World War II that made a kind of quick start, lockstep life possible. And that life is now dead for all of us.
I wonder at all if this is a class issue from either side of the spectrum. Either, you know, kids who are more well off have the luxury to put off adulthood, or conversely, kids who are more well off have the resources to be out on their own.
One of the really powerful stories that gets carried through all of our analyses is just how divergent the destinies of young people are. And that's really conditioned by where they're positioned when they start. In the book, we talk about kids who are kind of swimmers, treaders, and sinkers. It's a rough rubric. But, you know, the typical swimmer, the kid who's doing pretty well, has the strong support of parents. It's not just money. It's guidance and emotional support. These are kids who've got a good sense of their future. They're making really strategic decisions that are a good match to their skills and abilities. Treaders, and that's a big group of kids, have really precarious futures, and they look really different. You know, they're probably not the kind of kid who would have gone to college in an earlier era. They've heard that college is the way. They're not sure where it's all going, what they want to do. Often these are also first generation college students, who might have supportive parents, but whose parents just don't have the know-how about how to navigate college. And in work, too, treaders are the kinds of kids who are in low-paying service work, often with no benefits. You know, these are the kinds of kids who will hop from one job to another for a pay increase of 20 cents an hour. How many of us would do that?
And what about parents who might be looking at these kids who are not quite leaving the nest as quickly as they might have thought they would? Words of advice for them?
You know, I'd say parents be present. You know, the support of parents is probably the single most important determinant in terms of how young people fare as they're moving through their 20s. So I'd say, you know, step back if you do too much, if you're one of those parents who goes overboard, and step up if you don't do enough. Stay connected, give advice, guide, but, you know, again, don't go too far. I'd also say, you know, relax, stay involved, and remember that the world your kid is trying to navigate is inherently different from the one that you tackled at that age.
Dr. Richard Setterston is the co-author of Not Quite Adults, Why 20-somethings Are Choosing a Slower Path to Adulthood and Why It's Good for Everyone. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD, as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at AllyBank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name's Kevin McManus, and we're at an animal shelter in Los Angeles County. All right, so my wallet opens up, you know, basically just in half, and I have a little flap that holds my driver's license, and then on the other side I have, like, my credit cards and that kind of stuff. And the 20, the emergency 20, is tucked deeply beneath the driver's license side, so it's not easily seen and often forgot about for periods of time, although I always kind of know it's there. My school ID, an old school ID that I of a school that I haven't gone to in well over a year and a half, and another one for a school I haven't gone to in probably 3 years. But you never know when, you know, you have to get a discount on a movie ticket or a museum entrance or something like that. So I keep those handy. I actually successfully used one maybe a year ago to get into a museum for a couple bucks off. I am 37 years old, so I do get funny looks when I try to use the school ID, but it's valid, and there's no expiration date, which is the wonderful thing about it. So I just say I go gray early.
And finally, a peek behind the curtains here at Marketplace. If you had any illusions that we spend our workdays in posh surroundings, let me disabuse you. Our workplace is classic fishbowl. Senior staff have offices with windows. Everybody else sits in cubicles, complete with gray fabric walls, gray checkered carpet, and truly unfortunate fluorescent lighting. It's a setup familiar to many an American worker bee, but that style of workplace is going the way of the, let's say, fax machine. These days, it's all about open spaces, natural light, communication, and standing. We sent Marketplace cubicle veteran Stacey Vanek Smith to explore the workplace of the future.
I am a creature of the cubicle farm. I have spent my entire working life staring at a gray fabric wall covered with family photos and New Yorker cartoons, and I like my cubicle. I like having my own space, and I like that I can read celebrity gossip on TMZ.com or sneak a Snickers bar without anybody knowing. Matt Britton is the CEO of social marketing firm Mr. Youth. It was ranked one of the best places to work by New York Magazine. He says it's time to kill my beloved cubicle.
So we have different pods, glass curved walls, the creditably kind of funky vibe.
Mr. Youth's offices are open, loud, and lively. People work at long tables and in clusters of desks. Britton says this layout promotes creativity and collaboration.
Where somebody works and the way it's laid out has a huge impact on the culture. It impacts how they interact with one another. I think a cubicle farm creates a propensity for employees to kind of go off in their own world, you know, playing around on games or being on social networks.
Okay, for the record, I'm not playing around on TMZ. It's a serious news organization. Anyway, all over the country, cubicle walls are coming down. The open office layouts that began at tech startups are spreading to the mainstream. AT&T is building flexible spaces where employees don't have assigned desks. Intel has redone 1 million square feet of office space to include more collaborative areas. And the cubicle has been shrinking. It's about half the size it was in the 80s. Jim Keen is president of office furniture giant Steelcase Group.
Work is moving from individual work to collaborative work. So a lot more emphasis on places where people gather to make decisions, to share ideas, to innovate.
Keen says as technology becomes more mobile, workers are no longer chained to their desks, and companies are happy to save money by cutting back on individual space. At the same time, employers are trying to create environments that attract young talent and inspire their workers.
It absolutely changes the way we've worked.
The New Jersey Organ and Tissue Sharing Network deals with organ donors and transplant patients. It's an emotional job, and the company recently turned to Steelcase for a new office design, says Vice President Melissa Hanahan.
The glass allows light to come in. It's very bright, and we used very calming, soothing colors so that when families come to visit us, they can feel that, as well as our staff who can rejuvenate here.
Employee Maria DeLauro says it creates a sense of community.
There are some people here that I regularly interact with that in the old building I hardly ever saw. But now, because we have so much glass, you know, I could just like wave and at least you still feel connected. It feels more like a team.
Even the executive offices have glass walls and they don't have doors.
What is your name?
Barry Newman.
And you are the CFO?
Yes, I am.
And you don't have a door?
No, I don't.
Do people walk by and bug you like we just did a lot?
Of course. CFO sometimes can be a little intimidating to other employees, but I think this gives them the feeling that they can come in and see me.
Steelcase's Jim Keen says the traditional hierarchy of the office doesn't make sense for many of today's jobs, and workspaces are reflecting that, as well as a new focus on health.
As well-being becomes a bigger deal in the office, a whole variety of new solutions about getting people up and out of their chairs and moving around.
At the transplant center, a lot of people stand up at their workstations. Instead of a chair, the CEO walks on a treadmill at his desk. Keen says the modern office also promotes socializing and relaxation, with nooks and loungy spaces and flat-screen TVs. Melissa Hanahan shows me one at the transplant center.
This is actually one of the quieter places in the organization.
There's also a wine refrigerator.
Well, yes, there is a wine refrigerator. We use it at happy hour.
CEO Matt Britton says social marketing firm Mr. Youth also devotes space to recreation.
I mean, the basketball hoop, the Xbox, those are things that are almost expected right now.
You have an Xbox?
Plenty of them.
The office of the future has its perks and its drawbacks. Mr. Youth executive Dan LaFontaine says every once in a while, he longs for the good old-fashioned office door.
And there are those days when you want to walk in and just have peace and quiet. But what we get out of it is really collaboration, because you see all of your coworkers, and rather than have some kind of formal meeting, it's very easy just to grab a couple of people and get done when you need to get done.
Or, you know, take a break and play Halo. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
We've got photos of Stacey's cubby and others at marketplace.org/money. Also, check out our guest blog post from Rena Nadler. She's the co-author of the book Millennials in the Workplace. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook for all kinds of insider info about the show. And for links to more great personal finance stories, follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, no debating that taxes are complicated, but you can debate whether they're fair.
As I began my own tally this year, against this backdrop of political discord, I couldn't help but notice just how many breaks I get.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins, Stephen Hoffman, and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.